Exploring the Word of God together allows us to share in the joy that comes from discovering the words of hope and salvation which overflow from our Bibles. Upper Room Media presents to you this educational, enlightening, and entertaining Bible study. Prepare to be transformed.
We're going to talk about 1 Samuel chapter 11. It's a short chapter, so hopefully we won't talk for too long. Unless you guys have questions and things, but it would just be a nice quick Bible study, hopefully. So I haven't been here for the last couple of weeks. If someone's been here the last couple of weeks, what have we been covering for the last couple of chapters? Does anyone remember? Chapters 9 and 10 of the first book of Samuel. So we're talking about Saul. So we've been introduced to this character of Saul, that the people of Israel have asked for a king. God is not happy with that request. Samuel is not happy with that request. So they're being led now by Samuel, who's a judge. And they ask for a king, and God is not happy. Samuel feels he's been rejected. And God says to him, no, they have not rejected you. Have rejected me. And so, and he says, warn them, if they have a king, that that things are not going to go well for them. If they insist on having something that I've said that I don't want them to have, then it won't go well for them. And they insisted, they wanted a king, and they're given this man Saul. And do you remember what pleased the people about Saul so much? What's the main criteria, the thing that they loved about him? He was good looking. Big guy. He's the biggest. He had the biggest head, basically. That's how they decided that someone was like, I don't know, quality in those days. Was the distance from the neck to the top of the head was big. You know, he had a big head. And later on, Absalom, the king, they measure his worth by how heavy his hair was. So they cut his hair and it was heavy. You know, some of us would fail that badly. So he God picked this man Saul as king, and the people, they had a criteria, which was he needs to be good looking, as well as all these other things. He has to be a big physical man, looks like a warrior, which he was. But he was actually not just pleasing to the people. Saul was actually very pleasing to God. Saul was very pleasing to God as well. And God doesn't care about the way he looked, but he knew the people cared, so he said, fine, have that. But he cares more about the internal status of Saul. And Saul had a very high internal status at that stage. So I'm not sure what we talked about the last couple of weeks, but if you look closely at the last couple of chapters, you see the integrity of this man Saul and how good he was. Because he fails badly later. In a few chapters, actually the next chapter, or not the next chapter, chapter after, he's going to fail epically. And he gets rejected by God. And many people wonder about how does God choose someone that is doomed for failure? Why did God put someone in a position that is a horrible person for the position? Which Saul ends up being. He ends up being very bad. But all the fathers say that Saul actually started excellent. God picked the best person for the job. The problem was that Saul lost his way. Saul changed the way he was. But he was very good at the beginning. So that was the last couple of chapters. And we saw a lot of details about some of the things he did at the beginning of before he was anointed king and just after he was anointed. And this is another chapter. This chapter is, again, Saul showing his worth. Showing his worth in this chapter. Showing how high a status he was at the beginning. So that's chapter 11. Okay, so we'll read the first couple of verses and we'll give a bit of context. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So it's 1 Samuel chapter 11. Then Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, make a covenant with us and we will serve you. And Nahash the Ammonite answered them, on this condition I will make a covenant with you, that I may put out all your right eyes and bring reproach on all Israel. Then the elders of Jabesh said to him, hold off for 7 days that we may send messengers to all the territory of Israel. And then if there is no one to save us, we will come out to you. Okay, so we get introduced to this conflict that we're going to see in this chapter. Okay, this chapter is just about what happens in this little incident. Just this incident. That you have the king of the Ammonites, one of the enemies of Israel, coming out and saying, listen guys, we're going to invade you. I'm going to kill you all. If you don't want us to do that, by all means, you can serve us for the rest of your lives. And we're also going to take out the eye of one eye from everyone. So you're maimed enough to not rebel against us, but not bad enough that you can still serve us. So one eye is enough to serve us, but it's not good enough to beat us in war. That's the idea. So they're in a really horrible position, that they're either to be killed or to be slaves with one eye. So they're in a very bad position. In the next chapter, in verse 12, we see when Samuel summarizes the situation for them, he says, and when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord your God was your king. So this event is what triggered them to want to have a king. So they saw this danger of this king approaching them, and then they panicked and they said, we want a king. And so now we've gotten to the point, so when they asked for a king was a number of chapters ago, but when you read it in context, they've been waiting, they've been afraid of this moment for a long time. And in fact, this Nahash the Ammonite is not just going to take this city, he's going to continue to take more cities. So it's a very big event for the people of Israel that this guy comes and says that to them. For context. The name Nahash, so the man's name is Nahash, and in Hebrew, I think the name Nahash means serpent. That's the meaning of the word Nahash. And so in this setting, he's seen as a symbol of evil or a symbol of Satan. He's seen as a symbol of Satan. That he comes to when we are weak, and he comes to take away something that's integral to me spiritually, which is my eye. That's the idea. He's coming now to take away from them their eye, so that they're dysfunctional. And so for us, Israel represents us, represents humanity. That we can get to the point when we are blinded by sin, or we are slaves of sin, to the point where the devil can take away all my spiritual insight. I'm no longer putting up a fight. You see here that these people they're saying that we can't put up a fight, and please let us beg someone to come and help us. We can't do anything about this. We've stopped fighting. And spiritually, that's a disaster. If I get to the point in my spiritual life where there is a sin that is destroying me, and I stop fighting against it, it's a disaster. And the devil then comes and takes spiritual insight. And you'll no longer have insight that the sin is wrong, that it's destroying you. And of course, this happens to us all the time. That I get to the point where I stop feeling guilty for sin. And when I stop feeling guilty for sin, I stop recognizing its damage. That it is ugly, that it's destroying me. That my sexuality is out of control, and it doesn't matter to me that it's out of control. I don't realize that it's destroying my internal purity. It's leaving this chasm between me and God that I can't see anymore. And so, you know, in the Coptic church, we understand this concept of spiritual eyes. You know, in all the icons, if you look around at all the icons in the church, the eyes are designed in a certain way to show us that we look at things differently to the rest of the world. We see things from the eyes of God. And so you'll see even on the crucifixion icons, Jesus' eyes are always open. He's dying on the cross, but his eyes are always open. Because he's always seeing spiritually. Judas, if he's ever portrayed in an icon, how do they portray him if he's portrayed in an icon? Not
the side of his face.
Yeah, you see the side of his face, and you can't see his eye properly. Because he can't see. He's blinded. And Judas was a perfect example of that concept, that his sin, he stopped fighting against this love of money. To the point where he could no longer see how it was destroying him. and they could then give up Christ. So when I stop, when I can become to the point where I'm so weak that I do not even put up a fight against sin. And when I don't put up a fight against sin, the devil comes, and that's when he takes away everything. And that is exactly what this chapter is trying to tell us.
Father, just for context, why were the Ammonites trying to...
I don't know, but they're always enemies with the Israelites, so probably just expanding territory. In those days, often they were expanding territory, looting, maybe sometimes if they've had a disaster in their own land, they might come and kill all the men of another city so they can take their women to propagate. And that's exactly what I'll explain to you how that happened recently. But normally it's just expanding territory, show of power, that's the old school way.
Building an empire.
Building an empire. And so be careful of the sins that I've stopped fighting against. That's the point of this first part. Be careful of the things that I do that I stop recognizing are wrong. Because you'll become a slave to it. You'll become a slave. That you are unable to stop. And you see it all the time, for example, in drug addicts. That they are slaves. If you find anyone breaking and entering and doing some irrational crime, and they get caught because they don't hide their tracks, they don't realize that there's a camera, they're just crazy, and they do it for $200. You always look back, they scare the people that they do it to, but you look at why did they do it, and always it's because they could not control themselves because they needed money for an addiction, either a gambling addiction or a drug addiction, because they are a slave to it. They are unable to stop it. There's the obvious ones like drugs and gambling, but there's many other types of slavery that I cannot control myself. I'm unable to. I was reading about this a celebrity that died recently, and they were doing interviews with him before he passed away, and he was saying that when it came to women, I couldn't control myself. And he goes, I know I hurt many people in my life, he had many wives, but I could not ever control myself. I had no capacity and I didn't care. And you wonder, how do you get to that point where you don't care that you've hurt people that you love for the sake of something that I'm enjoying? That there's a problem there and that I'm blind to it. I'm blind to it. And that's what's happening here. Okay, so we'll read verse 3 and 4 now. Then the elders of Jabesh said to him, hold off for 7 days, that we may send messengers to all the territory of Israel, and then if there is no one to save us, we will come out to you. So the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and told the news in the hearing of the people. And all the people lifted up their voices and wept. You know, it shows how pathetic they were. How weak they were, that this guy is willing to allow them those 7 days. You think about it. I'm trying to extend my territory. These people are so pathetic, they can't put up a fight. And I say, hold on, just give us 7 days. The best thing to do is wipe them out straight away. You don't give them a chance. But this man, he realized how pathetic they were, how they had no chance against him, that he said, fine, take your 7 days. Of course, it undid him. It was a silly thing to do. But it shows, one, their status, how weak they were, and two, what arrogance does to a person. Because a lot of this chapter is going to be about humility, the humility of Saul. But Saul was so humble at the beginning. But this Nahash, he was arrogant. Fine, have your 7 days. And it destroyed him. It shows that the blindness of someone who is arrogant. And it is actually the opposite of spiritual insight when you are arrogant. Alright, so now we're going to read verse 5 and we'll get a bit more context. Now there was Saul coming behind the herd from the field, and Saul said, what troubles the people that they weep? And they told him the words of the men of Jabesh. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard this news, and his anger was greatly aroused. So he took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel by the hands of messengers, saying, whoever does not go out with Saul and Samuel to battle, so it shall be done to his oxen. And the fear of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out with one consent. All right. So Saul, he hears about the situation. He sees the people are upset, and he is compassionate. He says, "Let me resolve the problem." So he starts to resolve the problem. Now Saul was a Benjaminite. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. Now the tribe of Benjamin had a special relationship with the people of Jabesh Gilead already. If you go back to Judges, I didn't write a chapter. If you go back to the end of Judges, there's this incident in Judges where a man is traveling and he ends up in a city of Benjamin called Gibeah, which is where Saul was. And he walks in there and he's got some servants and I think his daughter. And the people of Gibeah who are drunk, who are out of control, they want to rape the man and the people that are with him. And there's an honest man in the city who takes him in. And he says, "Please don't do this to this man. He's my guest." And instead they rape, one of his servants, a female, and I think his daughter. Is that right? And they maim her and she dies from repeated rape over time. And she dies. So the rest of Israel hears about this incident and they are so upset by this incident that they kill the men of Benjamin. So they kill one of their own tribe, all the men. And then they feel sorry for the men of Benjamin. And they say, "Well, now that there's no men left, they're not going to be able to procreate, and we're going to wipe out the tribe." Does everyone remember this incident, or no one's ever heard of it before? So we're going to wipe out the tribe, and there's nothing we can do. So they need now women for these men to continue the lineage of the tribe of Benjamin. So they said to themselves, "Who did not come with us to this war to wipe out the Benjamites?" And they found one city that did not help them, which is Jabesh Gilead. Jabesh Gilead did not help them. So they then went and killed all the men of Jabesh Gilead, and they took the women and gave them to the people of Benjamin. Okay? So did you guys understand the story? See how now Benjamin is related to Jabesh Gilead?
So they killed all the women out of one tribe, all the men out of one tribe, what are you saying?
They killed all the men. I mixed it up. So what happened to Bun?
Yeah, because
they killed all the
women. They wanted to banish the men of this tribe.
Yeah, so they killed the men.
And then they wanted men for the wives to actually proclaim the same tribe again.
Yeah.
So they imported the people there.
From Jabesh Gilead. That's right. So they took the men.
They took the men out of Jabesh Gilead.
Yeah, but they also killed the men in Jabesh Gilead.
Well, some of them were punished.
So some killed and some were taken to procreate. The story is in the end of Judges. You'll find it there in the end of Judges. What's the idea? The idea is that there is a relationship between the two. And that's why Saul had a sensitivity to these people, that he wanted to look after them. Also, he has now been anointed king. So he feels responsible to look after them. So therefore he has a lot of compassion on them. And now we see how Saul's humility starts to come out. Number one, as a leader, he's been anointed king. But he's in his city just working as a normal man. He has not made himself a high status because he's king of the people. So he puts himself lowly from the very beginning. Number two, as a leader, he's very compassionate for the people that he serves. So he sees a responsibility there that I have to be compassionate on the people that I'm serving. And that's what he is. He's very compassionate for them. So he says, "What troubles the people that they weep?" And when he hears it, he has to take action. And he does take action. And he saves them. Number three, he says, "Look, who is going to come out with Saul and Samuel?" So he gives credit to Samuel, the prophet of God. So he doesn't just take the credit for himself. That he's done something good and he is going to do this victory essentially on his own. But he says, "Who's going to be with Saul and Samuel?" So he doesn't take the credit unto himself. These are all signs of humility. Signs. So if I am a compassionate person, if I have become cold, it goes against the idea that I am humble. If I take dignity to myself and refuse to let others take the credit for something, then it's a sign of arrogance and not humility. If If I don't want to help people, then again, it's a sign of arrogance. I just want to help myself. And then you see that God supports him because of his humility. So he was always supported by God at the beginning. And the main characteristic that Saul had, he had other virtues, but the main virtue was his humility. He was very lowly. And God blessed him at the beginning because of it. So it says that the Spirit of the Lord was on him, and that the fear of the Lord fell on the people. So he had the support of God. When you are lowly, God will support you. When you are arrogant, and later on, God says to him, he says, when you were small in your own sight, I supported you. I would have established your kingdom forever. But because you raise yourself up, I'll push you down. So humility was Saul's strength at that stage of life. Okay, verses 8 to 11. When he numbered them in Bezek, the children of Israel were 300,000 and the men of Judah 30,000. And they said to the messengers who came, thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh Gilead, tomorrow by the time the sun is hot, you shall have help. Then the messengers came and reported it to the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Therefore the men of Jabesh said, tomorrow we will come out to you, and you may do with us whatever seems good to you. So it was on the next day that Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp in the morning watch and killed the Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it happened that those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together. So, Saul affects this great victory. And again, you see more characteristic of Saul coming in. Number one, look at his trust in God and confidence in God. You know, to be humble is a very, it's an interesting characteristic. It means that I'm lowly. I think not a lot of myself. I don't think of myself as high. But somehow, in spite of that, I'm very confident. I'm incredibly confident. How? I'm confident that God will win the victory. The problem sometimes is that we as arrogant people, we think I cannot do it, and therefore I get despair. And sometimes despair is a sign of arrogance. It's not a sign of humility. It's a sign of arrogance. But when I am genuinely humble, Saul in this setting knows that he can't win the battle. But he knows that God can, and that the Spirit of God is on him, and that I can win because God is with me. And therefore he has a confidence that he's not unrelated to low self-esteem or arrogance. They're two separate things. Arrogance is self-confidence, whereas humility is confidence in God. And you see that Saul is incredibly confident as a person. And God then is able to guide him. The other thing that you realize about this is that Saul is not a warlord. Saul was not a warlord. Saul was a man who was looking after the horses of his parents, and he was not a warrior. But somehow, he was able to win a battle, split up into three companies, go in and kill the people and do whatever you need to do. And so, sometimes when we are given a task in front of God and we don't know how to do it, humility allows God to guide me. Humility allows me to do things that I would not otherwise be able to do, that even would never have occurred to me. But because God is allowed to work in the events, God is invited into the events because of my humility, then he can guide it. He can then guide Saul to make it break up into three companies, and he can, this is what you need to do to win this battle. Humility and prayer is an invitation to God. Arrogance and not turning to God is a rejection of God. It does not allow God to work with you. If you, for example, have a work interview and you go in there purely based on my achievements, purely based on my abilities, then God is not with you. It's up to you if you win or lose. Nahash, there you see, Nahash had power. He had the city under his control. and under his power, under his might. And he relied on himself. And because he did not recognize that there is a God, that there is someone who can help me, who cannot help me, then he got destroyed. Whereas someone like Saul, he understood there was God. He understood God is with me. And when God is with you, there is no power on earth that can stand against you. In any capacity. And it gives you confidence. It gives you power. It gives you honor. You know, after this, Saul was honored. He was honored by the people. Why? Because God is with him. When he does something, the fear of God was on the people. And you see that with some of the men of God. Because of their humility. This is not possible for someone who is arrogant. For God to work with them. For God to guide everything that they do. If you are arrogant, it's impossible. But if you are meek, then God is able to do that. He's able to use you in a very powerful way. And you see it many times. Pope Carlos was a perfect example of that. The man never spoke. He very rarely spoke. But he had a power. He had a fear. He, in the end, had the full respect of the president of Egypt. How? How does someone like Pope Carlos, a religious leader, have the control over the president of Egypt? That he could go in anytime he wants to have an audience with him. He could ask him whatever he wanted. Where does he get that power and that dignity? That power came from his meekness. And that the world could see that this man was a man of God. The second that you are not a humble person, then you are not a man of God. God cannot work with you. In verse 11, we'll just read verse 11 again. And so it was on the next day that Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp in the morning watch and killed Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it happened that those who survived were scattered, so that no two of them were left together. Gregory the Great, he compares, he says that these three companies, it's just like an allegory. The three companies are like the power of fasting in the law, the prophets, and by Christ. So there's three people in the Bible that fasted 40 days. Does anyone remember who they are? Who?
Moses.
Moses, who symbolizes
the law.
You got Jesus, who is God, yeah. And there's a third one, fast 40 days.
Elijah.
And he sees God, Elijah. And he symbolizes what? The prophets. So when Gregory the Great is commenting on this, he says that the power of fasting allows the power of the law, the prophets, and Christ. It's just an allegory that he says. And you know, an interesting thing that Saul has the virtue of humility. He has this virtue and he works on it and he builds it and he develops it. And then the product is success. You know, God rewards our virtue with success. He rewards virtue with success. If you want success in your life, in any part of your life, financially, academically, socially, whatever you want, God will reward you with that if I work on my virtues. I don't necessarily work towards the goal that I want. For example, I want financial success. I really want to be good in my career. If I spend more time developing my virtues, then God will give me the academic success that I want, or the career success that I want. Why? Why? Because if I develop, for example, humility, or if I develop courage, or if I develop selflessness, or if I develop forgiveness, if I develop these skills, then God sees that success would not destroy me. If I am humble, or I'm able to forgive, or I don't love money, then He sees that He gives me money, He gives me success, I will not become arrogant because I've developed my skill of humility, my virtue of humility. So Saul, he has developed a skill in humility. He's developed courage. He's developed certain virtues. And God rewards him with success. Success, material success. Even material success will be given to you if you spend your time developing virtue. Another reason why God insists on you working towards your virtue, not towards the things you want, is because he wants you to understand that it's him who's giving it to you, not you taking it yourself. If you, all you think about is that I studied, but I did not care at all about my virtue and you succeed, then you'll always believe that you did it yourself. That it was you who has your mind. You gave yourself intelligence. When God wants to remind you that he gave you intelligence. He gave you that skill. He gave you that personality. And that's why you're so socially successful. Because that personality was given to you by God. So if you don't develop your virtue, God will take it, success away from you. Because you don't understand where it's from. It's a principle. God wants honor. He wants glory. He wants to be known for what he's done in your life. Not for his sake, but for your sake. He wants you to remember that he gave that to you so that you can get more from him, not less. So it is very important that we work on our virtue if we want success. If you work towards your success all your life, then you may never get it. And if you do, you'll come out with no virtue. So it's very important that you work on your virtue if you want success. And God will give you success if you work on your virtue. And naturally as well, when you are forgiving, when you are loving, when you are humble, you will naturally progress more in life anyway. Not the other way around. Alright, verse 12 and 13. Then the people said to Samuel, "Who is he who said, 'Shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death.' But Saul said, 'Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished salvation in Israel.'" There's a really, really nice quote here from St. John Chrysostom about humility and how attractive humility is in the face of this kind of thing. So I'll read it to you. "There is nothing of more benefit to others and that draws the hearts to God more than the meekness of him who is insulted, oppressed and afflicted, who bears all that with a smiling face and great calm as though there is nothing wrong going on." So I'll read that again. It's a really nice quote from St. John Chrysostom. "There is nothing of more benefit to others and that draws the hearts to God more than the meekness of him who is insulted, oppressed and afflicted, who bears all that with a smiling face and great calm as though there is nothing wrong going on." He's saying that there is nothing that can attract people to God more than you being humble, meek, not attacking, not defending yourself, allowing yourself to be insulted or humiliated. There is nothing more attractive. And we know that in humanity, we know there's nothing uglier than conflict, and there's nothing more attractive than when someone humbles themselves for the sake of another. It is a very high level. It's a very powerful thing, and it is the thing that attracts people to God. We think sometimes evangelism will attract people to God, or educational programs or social programs. But the thing that attracts people to God is humility. It's showing them God. It's showing them who God is. He's humble, he's meek. And I show them through the way I am. And we'll finish the chapter now. "Then Samuel said to the people, 'Come, let us go up to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there.' So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. Then they made sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly." So there was great joy, and Saul became the official king in Israel. And the last lesson is that when God does give you success, when you have prayed for something and God gives it to you, don't forget to thank him. Don't forget to thank him. Many, many times we pray for something, we beg for something, we get what we want, and we completely forget that God has had any place here. I don't thank him. I don't regard him. I even forget that I asked. It's important that we thank God for the things that he does for us. And Saul did. And Saul now is the official king. After this, he starts to go on his downward spiral. Up till now, he's on up. But he starts to go down after this point because he starts to lose that sense of humility. That he was riding on momentum for a long time. He was very great. He rode on momentum for some time and then he started to drop. Spiritual momentum can only carry you so far and then you will start to drop. So you always have to be working on the gifts that God has given you. Any questions or comments on this chapter? Okay, so the question is, so I said before that work on your virtue and God will give you success. And if God wouldn't give you success if you don't have the virtue to match. And so why then did Saul have success? The answer is that Saul did have the virtue to match. Saul was incredibly humble. He was a very high status, plus he was king. If God was going to establish the people of Israel, he needed the kingdom of Israel to be strong. And it was under David and under Solomon. It was incredibly strong. So Saul was in a position where he could handle the gifts that God gave him, and he did. But he stopped trying. And once he stopped trying, he fell. And then God took away his success. Saul failed dismally after that. People started to say, well, David killed 10,000, Saul killed his thousands. And every time he tried to catch David, he couldn't. He started to lose battles. He started to be frustrated, angry, agitated all the time. So God actually took away his success. And also success is more than just the material. It's an internal thing. It gives me success in terms of my peace, in terms of my comfort, in terms of my love, in terms of my joy. It gives me all these things. Saul lost all of that. When he lost his virtues, he lost everything. Even when he had money, it made no difference to him. It was meaningless. It was really meaningless. And that is exactly what happens to us if we lose our virtue. If you have material success without virtue, it becomes to you meaningless, comes to you a source of depression. You know, I met someone recently who was incredibly successful. And he was telling me that he's not an old man, he's in his 50s. He said, soon I would be at the point where I would never have to work again. And I live in a very expensive home. But in a moment, my life has been flipped upside down. Because he took his family for granted and was unfaithful to his family. His family discovered it and he's lost his family. And he said that, and he was sad. And he said, I never have to work. I'm wealthy. Everything in my life is perfect. I have a good family. And I threw it all away. So to him, his wealth was actually more depressing. His success was more depressing, not less. It made him more depressed because he'd lost his virtue. He'd given it away. He didn't count it as something valuable to him. So sometimes material success will be to you a source of more anxiety if you don't have virtue to match it. And it was to Saul as well. He was king, but he was so anxious about someone taking over his kingdom. He had all the wealth in the world, but he was worried he would have nothing. He was irrational, but that's how he was. So God will take it from you, or it will be, you'll just lose it, or it will be meaningless to you if you don't have virtue to match it. You will not be able to enjoy it. Any other questions? Glory be to God.
This talk was brought to you by Upper Room Media. We hope that this talk has, through the grace of God, touched your heart. And we pray that it will not only inform you, but will also transform you and your life with Christ.